This is a massive project. What brought you to this subject? Why take this on?
So I was working on a project on the writer Zora Neale Hurston, and I was working on her film work because she was, I'm not sure if anyone thought this before me, probably they did, but she was probably the first professional African-American woman filmmaker. So she traveled to the South in the late 1920s, recording the stories of, and also recording the people, of mostly African-American communities in the South, in Florida and Alabama. And I was trying to identify the people in her films. One of those people was a man named Kazula, or Kujo Lewis, who was long thought to be the last survivor of the Clotilda slave ship. But Hurston wrote about another person in a letter to Langston Hughes, not naming, but alluding to another Clotilda survivor. And as I was trying to name the people in her films, I was looking in this posthumously published book of hers, noticed in an appendix to that book that she'd listed the names. And one of the names was Sally Smith, born Tarqua, Gold Coast, Africa. So I realized then that person was the unknown Clotilda survivor and had a name. So I tried to tell her story, and it spiraled from there, basically.
It certainly did spiral. It looks like you have an actual manifest from the ship. Were you able to find all those 110 people?
Yeah, so not all of them, sadly, but a large number of them. So probably, I think, more than 80, more than that if you include the people who probably died during the voyage across the Atlantic.
How many did actually survive the trip?
We can't be 100% certain. So the captain of the ship, William Foster, recorded that he managed to smuggle 110 people onto the ship. When the ship landed in Mobile Bay in July 1860, a U.S. Marshal, he actually found them and counted 103. And we also know from accounts by Clotilda survivors, a little girl and a man drowned, or were thrown overboard, rather. In another account, two little boys were thrown overboard. There are anonymous handwritten notes in Mobile Public Library that record the death of a 16-year-old girl 2 days out, and then a 14-year-old girl as well.
This all took place, legendarily, because of a bet. What was the bet?
So I didn't really believe in this bet because it sounded too frivolous, right? This is, you know, these are zealots. These are people who really believe in continuing the slave trade, well, in slavery. But I found evidence. I managed to identify one of the people who was named as a witness to the bet. So I found out that enabled me to work out what exactly when it happened, because he wrote an autobiography in which he talked about visiting the South. He was a northerner and he visited the South in the winter of 1855 to early 1856, just after the Clotilda had gone on its first maiden voyage. So there's an interesting timing there. But the people who lead this voyage are, as I said, zealots. And the client of this northern businessman was a man named Benjamin Rush Jones. And Benjamin Rush Jones was very closely associated with a man named William Lowndes Yancey. And William Lowndes Yancey is known as the orator of secession and the prince of the Fire Eaters. And the Fire Eaters were this extreme sect that were demanding secession as early as 1850. And William Lowndes Yancey is the man who leads a walkout of Southern Democrats at the Democratic National Convention in the spring of 1860, just as the Clotilda is sailing across the Atlantic. And that walkout leads to the party splitting in two. You have a Southern Democrat party in the 1860 presidential election. That split leads to Abraham Lincoln's election. So the Republicans, with party which is opposed to the expansion of slavery, that wins the election. And that in turn, yeah, leads the South to secede from the Union, Southern states to secede from the Union. So there's some really close connections. And also some of the Clotilda survivors were held in Montgomery, which was, of course, the first capital of the Confederacy.
What was the actual bet?
So what appears to have happened, apparently, is that this northern businessman says it would be impossible to bring in new enslaved people, basically. And then somebody else says that it would be possible. And then the captain of the steamboat, where the bet happens, this man named Timothy Mayer, is supposed to have come in and said, I'll do this, or, I'll, you know, here's more money, and I bet I can do it myself. And Timothy Mayer and his two brothers, James and Burns, are really at the heart of this trafficking operation.
And at that point, the slave trade had technically been illegal for about 50 years or so. It seems like the trip, they were dodging slaver patrols the entire way.
Yeah, so the U.S. did abolish its slave trade in 1808, and it becomes piracy in 1820, which means it's a capital offense. You can be executed for it. But it's not very well policed, really, until the eve of the Civil War. But it's certainly true that according to the Clotilda's captain's account, Captain William Foster's account, that he is dodging anti-slavery patrols en route to West Africa and also on the West African coast as he's forcing his captives aboard the Clotilde.
You tell a lot of stories in the book about women who were captured and brought to the country. How rare is that to find women's stories among the enslaved?
It's incredibly rare. I mean, according to a historian, there are about four accounts left by, I mean, this doesn't include Phyllis Wheatley, the poet, though, but four accounts by middle passage survivors who were women, middle passage survivors who were sent to English speaking parts of the Americas, at least. There's like two petitions from, I think, Barbados, and another, there's something very, very brief from Massachusetts. And also there's a Jamaican fragment of a memoir. But these barely mention the Middle Passage at all. In fact, I think only two of them do. So there's probably more substantial accounts among the Clotilde survivors and the accounts I've put together in this book, certainly of women and girls, than anywhere else on record.
It seems the captives formed a bond while they were on the ship. How close were they able to stay together once they reached the mainland and, you know, started to be sold off?
Yes, so they're separated and scattered throughout. About 30 of them are enslaved in Mobile. The rest descend to the cotton belt of central Alabama mostly. So not only do the Mobile Africans establish their own town, a township north of Mobile, but at least two of the Clotilde survivors who are sent to the cotton belt, who are sent to Wilcox County, Alabama, somehow find their way back down 150 miles south, back to Mobile, more than 20 years after they're taken away from each other. A survivor called Quilla Wheeler and another survivor called Osser Allen. And what's striking about Osser is that he dies in the 1890s, so he disappears from the historical record. But there's evidence to show that his son is raised by another Clotilde survivor. And according to census data, that child is her nephew. So what that tells us is that Osser Allen is reuniting with his sister in Mobile when he makes his way back down to Mobile in the 1880s.
That town above Mobile, Africa Town, were a lot of the Clotilde survivors there?
Yeah, about 30 of them, approximately 30. Yeah, not all of them survived the Civil War, very sadly. But this community, mostly children or very young people, established a township. First of all, they try desperately to go home, and they almost get the help of a missionary to go home. I mean, he tries to help them to go home, but there's no money. So what they do instead is they buy land just north of Mobile and establish what they call African Town. And they establish a community where they have a leader and two judges to preside over the community. They establish their own church and school and manage to persuade the state to give them a teacher to teach their children. And of course, by the 1870s, they also establish their own graveyard outside the church as well as they begin to die. But this community is a thriving community. So by the early 20th century, it's a community of about 2,000 to 3,000 people. The businesses are almost all black owned. The most successful people in the community are the Clotilde survivors themselves. Charlie Lewis is the most successful businessman in the community. And when he dies, that title passes to Osiah Kibi, who's another survivor.
Talk, if you can, about the quilters you talk about in the book at G's Bend.
Yes, so in the early 21st century, that community starts to receive a lot of attention from art historians for its unusual quilting patterns. So, I mean, before that, actually, there's a Freedom Quilting Bee, which is the same area. So the Freedom Quilting Bee is a cooperative established by civil rights leaders or civil rights campaigners in the 1960s. And their artwork is exhibited at the Smithsonian, so that received attention. But by the beginning of the 21st century, there's this national spotlight on G's Bend. And these quilts are famous for their unusual patterns and their abstract shapes, these unusual designs. And there were suggestions 20 years ago that, and in fact, possible evidence that one of the early quilters was a Clotilde survivor. But these quilts were likened to West African strip weaving, which is a tradition of sort of weaving strips of fabric into a single cloth. And there was a tradition of strip weaving in Oyo State, Nigeria, which is where most of the Clotilde survivors appear to have come from. But quite a lot of the Clotilde survivors end up either in G's Bend or very close to. So Rehoboth, which is next door to G's Bend, is where the two survivors who make it south to Mobile, where they were enslaved. So Quilla Wheeler and Osser Allen.
Do we know for a fact that the Clotilde was the final slave ship that docked in the U.S.?
I don't think we can know that for a fact simply because it's, yeah, I mean, I think all of the evidence that I can see based on very close scrutiny of census data suggests there wasn't a significant shipment of people, certainly to Alabama at this time. But I don't think we can ever rule it out because it's quite horrible, really, that it's cheaper to traffic people across the Atlantic or to buy traffic people from across the Atlantic than it is to buy people from the upper South. They're only paying $50 to $100 to buy people. I mean, obviously you have to pay for the ship, et cetera, but you can make it a very profitable enterprise if you're sending lots of ships across the Atlantic. But $50 to $100 to buy someone in West Africa and then more like $1,000 to buy them from the upper South. So you can see one reason why people so want to do this.
Other than those quilters, is there any influence of these people that we can see today? I know you spoke some of early civil rights.
Yeah, so the Clotilda survivors were those who were sent to Montgomery into Selma, or close to Montgomery into Selma. So Bujah Moore is separated from her three small children, including a baby, which she's sold at Ouida on the West African coast. She lives for another 70 years without her children. But she travels into the heart of Montgomery twice a week up until 1925. She's doing what she would have done back home. She's a tradeswoman as she would have been back home. She's living that life. And she's selling her wares along Dexter Avenue, which is where Rosa Parks refuses to give up her seat on a bus to a white man. It's also where, of course, where the state capital is, which was the first capital of the Confederacy. She probably knew E.D. Nixon, who was the first leader of the Montgomery bus boycott. And over in Selma, Matilda McCrea, who lived until January 1940, she was just 2 years old when she was kidnapped and sold across the Atlantic. In December 1931, she walks from her home. She walks about 15 miles from her home in rural Dallas County to the Dallas County Courthouse to demand reparations. And of course, she's turned away by the white judge. But Dallas County Courthouse is where the Selma voting rights campaigners gathered to demand their voting rights, which ultimately leads to the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Radoshi, another survivor, knew Amelia Boynton Robinson, who's really leading that campaign and invites Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to Selma at the start of the Selma to Montgomery marches. And of course, their children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren are involved. So Matilda McCrea's grandson is arrested in Selma during the Civil Rights Movement. And her great-grandchildren, at least three or four of them, are part of the Children's March, which is, demanding segregation, where thousands of children are arrested for basically marching through Birmingham to demand an end to segregation.
This is a fascinating book. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.